When you're playing Atlanta United in their house in the first leg of a playoff game and you just think, you know what, let's give them the possession for this one. It's That's So MLS. With myself, Nick Thornton, with me as always is Andrew Bates. Andrew, how are you doing after a busy night of playoff action?
I'm doing very good. There was a lot of sports all happening at once because the Grey Cup was also happening. The Canada Women's FIFA U17 Women's World Cup was happening, and Canada was in the quarterfinal of that. I spent a lot of time this weekend following a match that never took place in the in the Copa Libertadores final, which was amusing. So it was
the greatest match you've never watched.
It's the greatest match I've never saw. I tuned in when it was supposed to take place at 4. There was a lot of watching various soccer business people walk in and out of doors and just fans wilt over the course of 2 hours of standing in the heat with nothing happening.
Yeah. Nutty stuff. Nutty stuff.
Also nutty was the playoff action. I feel we had in the two games very opposite styles of games, because you had one where everything seemed very nailed down, and then you had one where it seemed like it's impossible to stop the bleeding.
Very much so, yes. Where do we want to start here? Which game? It's weird to only have two games to discuss. It feels like so much more happened, but
this is
where we are.
Let's start at the beginning with Atlanta versus the Red Bulls.
Yes.
This had always been considered sort of a, I want to say like a very even series, because the two teams had been very close through the regular season. A lot of people sort of suggested that I'm trying to find the exact scoreline of the last regular season meetup, but New York seemed like they really had the best of the matchup during the regular season.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to verify what the actual season stats on that were. Yes, here it is. Yeah, New York, it was like three New York wins and one nil-nil draw. So it had seemed, you would have thought, like, you know, that New York really had a key chance here, but a lot of people had been... A lot of people sort of observed them switching to what?
I was just laughing because I, like, observed them not playing well.
Just not playing good. I'm trying to remember. I remember hearing, I'm just trying to match up what my memory was of what I heard. I think that the idea is that they stopped pressing as much and they sort of boxed up to try and choke out access to Martinez, right?
Yeah.
And that didn't go great.
It did not work, in fact. Yeah, because it looked like at a certain point Parker was pushing up higher and was almost sort of acting as a bit of a sweeper in there. You know, it's interesting because MLSsoccer.com, the week leading up, was running this story about, is New York Red Bulls the best team in MLS ever? Which seems to be an annual thing they do now with teams, is whatever team wins the Supporter Shield is now the best team in MLS ever. And I think Atlanta took notice and just said, hold my beer! Hold my beer! There was really no point in this game that Red Bulls looked like they had anything in it. Aside, of course, from the offside goal that was disallowed, which we'll get to. But this was just a shocking... All three Atlanta goals are so preventable. And, of course, that's easy to say when you're not having to defend against them. But there's just so much space, and especially that third goal. You just see that there's nobody making any attempt to win the ball. And, you know, when we get to the specifics of the goal that was called back for being offside, and as whether you agree with that or not, the point is, if you're going to go to Atlanta... and you're going to have a call go against you, and you're going to give up after that, you are going to lose 100% of the time. And they knew that going in. So it's really, even if it's not a fair call, in your opinion, it's not an excuse that they totally lost sight of their game plan. They look completely outgunned on every part of the pitch. And just out of shape, too. I mean, the huffing and puffing to keep up with Atlanta, which I understand because Atlanta's an incredibly physically fit team and passes so quickly, but the sort of trying to box out Martinez thing was just such a disaster because it opened up all kinds of space for the wings that just broke New York so many times. What was your read on this game?
So I also sort of focus in on this game plan thing because when you look at what has worked for the Red Bulls and what hasn't, it's not so much that they're exploitable. It's that sometimes the team that shows up is not able to sort of have that game plan together. You know what I mean? Like rather than they have a game plan that has vulnerable parts in it, they don't always execute exactly the way that they would like to do. And I know that one of the things that sort of affected that was the absence of Kamar Lawrence, mm-hmm. who I heard had an injury in training or something that prevented him from appearing. But this idea that they're not going to do the press and they're going to focus on trying to choke up the area, in this first goal on the 33rd minute, they've got these two lines of three, and they're just sort of standing around Martinez, and they're not pressuring him at all before this ball comes in from Laurentiis.
I was going to say, because Parker is in position on Martinez and tries to jump for the header, but he's nowhere near Martinez and just misreads it. And then Martinez is able to slide through. And for me, Robles has actually got to get up and make himself big there. I think he probably thinks Martinez is going to try to dink it by him. But I feel like goalkeepers should have enough experience with him by now to know that if he's 6 inches away from goal, he's going to smash it every single time. So a number of errors are made there, but as you said, everybody's just standing there watching, and that was kind of the theme of this game, that you just think, like, I mean, really, the Red Bulls did it to themselves. The intensity that's needed to defend this team is incredible, and they just didn't seem very switched on for most of it.
When you are away, especially in the first leg, and you're in this ground, this was my take on sort of what the big letdown was, is not even necessarily conceding that goal, but like the fact that it was so early in the game, and there didn't really seem to be. Atlanta didn't seem to have to work very hard to do it. Like it.
Oh
wasn't,
no, they were in second gear this whole game.
And I thought if you are letting that kind of goal in now with half an hour still to go in this game, you are not like the number
it's
one.
It's going to be a long night.
You could say, oh, well, we want to get an away goal or whatever else. But I feel like your number one, like the game plan that we see from Atlanta, especially in this venue, is to absolutely blow people away and totally overwhelm them and sort of catch them into routes because they're so shell-shocked that they can't reply. And I feel like that, even more than holding them
it
off,
works. It worked so spectacularly in this game.
And even more than just like we have to defend, I feel like we have to this is the exact darkest timeline that Red Bulls should have averted.
And I mean, take nothing away from the creativity of this team and the way that Tata sets them up for success. That can't be overstated. That's the thing that's allowed them so much success. But they played the most Atlanta United game ever. They did exactly what you would expect them to do. There was really no surprises here from Atlanta. So I don't quite understand what the game plan for New York was going in, that they thought they would be able to deal with this. Because we've seen the few times that Atlanta gets beat or drawn at home, it's you've got to match their level of intensity. That if you can come out of the gate flying as well and exploit the spaces that they leave, because so much focus is put on these aggressive darting runs forward, you know, you can hit them on the counter, but there just never seemed to be any real opportunity for that. which I just think is very, very curious. This wasn't just a case of like, oh, Atlanta's that much better, and of course they're going to win. I think that there's a way the Red Bulls could have at least drawn this game, but not with the formation that they played, and not with the style of play that they had. It never looked like they were going to get a point out of this one.
No. Here's where we come to this goal. And a lot of people have this. A lot of people have had a lot of opinions on this one. It's 1-0 at this time. It's true that they didn't have momentum, but you know, scoring a goal can change things. And the commenters tried to say, "Oh well, maybe even just seeing the ball go in will wake them up." It clearly didn't. Bradley. Okay, yeah. So it's a free kick. A free kick is made. Alex Moyle is offside the whole time, but it's kind of like the line rises up to meet him, and he never interacts with the ball. The ball comes to Bradley Wright Phillips, who smashes it in. Everybody thinks this is a standard Bradley Wright Phillips goal, a classic Bradley Wright Phillips goal. But then VAR calls it back because of Moyle's positioning. I can't point to a specific instance where I've heard this before, but I find MLS's rules on when you are offside and when you stop being offside to be really frustrating and to be incredibly unclear, because it seems like people can disallow goals by having been offside any time in the last year.
Is it? Yeah, truly. Is it that the rules are unclear, or is it that they are not applied consistently?
I think it's the latter. I think that's what a lot of people are pointing out when it comes to this goal, is that they feel...
Because I think, yeah, letter of the law, he's offside and he's interfering with he's screening the goal. And that screening of the goal is in the rule. I mean, I have three differing opinions on this, but the last one sort of negates the first two. But I also agree. Like I think the rules are somewhat clear, but these types of rules go, they're always clear until something actually happens and you need to apply it. But the fact is that there isn't really a clear precedent for this type of call, because we've seen even this season where this same play has been an allowed goal. And a lot of people are pointing to Guzan's reaction, where he's just disappointed he's letting a goal. He makes no attempt to argue it. He doesn't go to the referee. He picks up the ball and kicks it out. Which, that being said, though, he's not the referee.
Yeah, and it regardless of whether or not the goalkeeper wants to appeal it, they have to they have to do it. So your first point is.
My first point is, especially with the camera angle from behind the net, he's offside and he's interfering with the play.
Yes.
It's no goal. My second opinion, though, is that of the consistency rule, that in a major playoff game, to decide to call this one back when there isn't a precedent for it, I think is extremely harsh. That being said, it's not in that moment, it's not the video assistant referee's call to go back and think about every time this same play happened. But this is the thing that we've heard players and coaches be so frustrated about this season, is it's not so much the use of VAR, it's the, as in like VAR yes or no, it's how it's being applied and the lack of consistency from it that seems to be the issue. That it's definitely made some great calls and prevented some, you know, saved some teams a chance. But then there's been other times where it's just like, okay, but why now? Why this one? Why is this a reviewable play, and why is this one called offside when 3-4 months prior the same thing happened and that goal was allowed? Like, where's the consistency and where's the communication with the referees association that's allowing them to make the correct call?
It's funny that you should mention that, because we have this this clip. We heard from Kai
Kamara. See how I set that up?
You set that up. Now I'm going to
tap it
in.
Now did I ruin it?
I'm going to tap it in. With, you know, last week we heard from Kai Kamara as a part of the Whitecaps press conference. And one of the things that wasn't able to make it due to space was when I asked him, what do you think of the league? Where it's at, his first thoughts went to VAR. So here's that, him talking about that now.
The league you walked into in 2006 looks wildly different than the one that happens now, that exists now. And the sort of the intrigue over Columbus's future was a part of that, those discussions this season. What do you think of the state of the league and where it's headed?
The league is growing. Everybody says that. It's one thing I'm going to say, but whatever, I'm going to say it. Everybody says the league is growing, but as the league grows, the referees have to grow. That's the one big thing about this league. You know, these decisions we're waiting for VAR to make for us and blah, blah, blah. We see other leagues, and they're using VAR, but it's so much better. It takes like 5 seconds for them to decide what's happening. You know, but we can't be looking at the league. Even before me, the league has been around for so long. But yeah, from 2006 on, how much the league have grown. Fans have grown. Stadiums, new stadiums and everything. And everyone is saying all these good things about MLS. MLS is going all around the world. But then it's so, you know, bad officiating. Then that's not helping the growth of the league. So, yes, MLS is growing. And yes, the players know that. And it's hard even for players to come. A lot of people are calling me all the time. I want to come play in MLS. Players that's playing in England and playing, you know, in Spain and all these places. How can I get to MLS? I say, it's really hard now. You know, but then when I'm sitting at home and watching the game and something happens and these guys are officiating games and it's not, you know, good enough. That's not helping the growth of the league. And that's how I see it.
Whew.
So, Kamara, the VAR concerns are first and foremost in Kamara's mind. What if anything could have been done to make this particular one hurt less?
I'm not sure, and this is where opinion number three comes in that I think negates the other two. Mm-hmm. I think in a case where, you know, there's so many things, and I know lots of people disagree with this. There's so many calls that happen in a season and games that you just, it's such a clear injustice to someone. And we've all felt like we were the victims of that at some point. But in calls like this, where it's 50-50, I think you have to err on the side of caution and let the letter of the law guide you. It's frustrating as hell that it's not applied consistently. But in that moment, what are we saying? That because if we want consistency, it has to start somewhere. And so the referee is looking at the letter of the law and makes the correct call. And just because a precedent might still be a bad precedent. For me, what can be done to take the sting out of it is some more open and honest dialogue from the referees in the off season that maybe engages the supporters a little bit more to say that, like, it's not so much a thing against VAR, but exactly as Kamara said, is that there's just these really horrendous cases still of officiating that tarnish the whole thing. And really what people want is consistency so that they know. Because the one thing I'll say is it's very clear that the players on the field don't seem to know the rules. The coaches seem confused by it and how things are being applied. And the referees themselves, depending on who it is, seem to be confused. So, like, let's all get on the same page at least so that we know. But it's soccer. There's always going to be subjectivity to it and an ability to mess up a call. But
It feels like the application has really shifted over the course of the year, especially about, as we'll talk about later, having the flag up or down, or you know, how calls are made before VAR comes in. I do like your idea about, you know, I guess there's no time better time to start than the present in terms of applying things to the letter of the law, because it's, you know, everybody thinks of that 2012 USA-Canada game where there was the call around holding the ball, the goalkeeper holding the ball for longer than 10 seconds. And that was awful at the time, and I still, you know, it still feels like injustice. But everybody knows how long you have to release the ball now, huh?
Well, exactly. And it's also like to claim ignorance of the rules, I don't think is good enough. But certainly what doesn't help is when they're being applied inconsistently. But we'll get to it when we talk about Portland and Sporting Kansas City, of how, you know, also it's well known in MLS that playoff games are refereed a little bit differently. And referees have decisions to make about how, as happens in every other league as well, when it comes to big games, referees have decisions to make about how they're going to run the game. So every game is a little bit different. But I don't see why we can't have some sort of MLS town hall where, you know, the head of the pro referees answers some questions and gets some feedback. And then we see that there's a process of, can we get the referees on the same page? Can we just get them all on the same page? Yeah, I mean, it's like the red card situation this year. It was so obvious that even coaches had no idea sometimes what was going to be considered a red and what wasn't, and just seemed to be an in-the-moment decision that can have such a massive impact on games. Nobody's saying there shouldn't be red cards. It's just there were cases where it wasn't clear how something was a red card offense, and then the referees wouldn't give a reason. And if anybody questioned them, then they'd send off that person too, which is, you know, I think there needs to be more transparency with it. That's the big thing.
So you have got this. I'm all of a sudden looking at the wrong game here. You've got this the 3-1 away game that New York won, which they would have much rather had that scoreline. But yeah, they were not able. To find their way back to 1-1 in a situation where they had the opportunity to do so. And then on the 71st minute, you have this beautiful movement that eventually Franco Escobar scores the second, and this is where you start to see the bleeding stop occur. Gressel and Martinez are running this play where it looks like Gressel is going to try and get the ball to Martinez and are pushing the defense back, and the defense is all sort of charging around Martinez, and then Martinez just dummies it, does not interact with the ball, and it rolls back into acres of space where Franco Escobar is waiting to hit an amazing long range shot. That was also, you know, the quality of the strike was also a huge part of the goal. But it was very much a sort of a clever setup.
Absolutely. And that's where, again, wanting to be fair to Atlanta, this wasn't just New York Red Bulls giving up and digging themselves a hole. This really was Atlanta's brilliant execution. I mean, that play in particular, this is where they've had success, is that teams flock around one player to cover them and leave other players completely unmarked. And then you remember, okay, yes, they've got this guy who's, what, he's up to like 34, 35 goals now. That's a concern. But you also have five or six other players that can bang in goals at will also. And so part of their offensive strategy is having Martinez be the villain up top and the guy taking away attention that actually builds so much space for their other players.
Yeah.
And Martinez, I don't know if it's the neck tattoos or what, but I don't think gets enough credit for how intelligent of a player he is. He's a very smart striker. He's a poacher. He's an excellent finisher. But also, that play was a perfect example of he knows when not to be greedy and to let something run, because he sees his guy coming in, steaming down the right flank. He knows where he is.
Well, if you even think of, like, you know, people not being greedy, a lot of people thought that Miguel Almiron coming back from injury was a huge turning point for Atlanta. And I think he has, even though in a game like this, he didn't find the net. But just his presence, like Martinez, drawing attention as much as anything, also is so dangerous.
Well, and it's just the movement of Atlanta. Like, and this is where it's so hard to defend against a team like this, is where there's so much movement of players and the ball that it really, if you have a sort of more set system like New York Red Bulls does, it pulls players out of positions because they're having to man mark. And so, especially with a player like Martinez, who really doesn't have a position, and Almiron's the same, they can play wherever they want. So it makes it really difficult to do any type of zonal marking or man-to-man marking, because they're constantly pulling defensive players out of position and creating space in other areas. So that's, for me, the great asset of Almiron, is not just these brilliant plays that he's able to make or some of his brilliant goals. It's the fact that when he's driving forward with the ball and he's maybe holding on for it for 1 second and he takes a touch, but he sees everything around him and then he opens up space because players run to cover him.
Absolutely.
But he's a very hard player to get the ball off of. And any MLS team that has a player like that, not even just of Almiron's skill level, but the ability to create space and open things up for other people, I think that's why him and Martinez are so successful. It's not just the execution of things, it's the space they're able to create with the amount of ground they cover.
Absolutely. So New York had a tough first half, and then they try to, reshuffle it, and they can't get their goal, and they concede a second. Not very good, but, you can't always plan to not concede twice in Atlanta. This last goal in injury time, I just wrote down, oofa doofa.
That's accurate, yes.
Martinez and scores. Or no, it's not Martinez.
It is
Villalba. Yes. Found wide open.
Yeah. Here's how I sum up that goal. After the game, Luis Robles said, New York comeback task is near impossible. And I felt like that was the mindset at that point, that the second goal is where New York Red Bulls lost, and they gave up. And there cannot be excuses. Again, like Atlanta United is a known entity. So is Mercedes-Benz Stadium.
Yeah.
You've got to get in there and fight. You've got 8 minutes of added time. Granted, they're kind of caught on the counter a little bit, but it was just everything said about it, that there was just no pressure on that ball whatsoever. And no player, Villalba's got like five good long Mississippis to think about it, while defenders just stand there.
It almost felt like when Atlanta, I wasn't able to track when New York coughed up the ball, but it almost seemed like they had coughed up the ball and they were just sort of counting on the idea they would get the ball back, so they didn't shift into a defensive posture. You know what I mean? Like, they were starting to move upfield and they were like, okay, well, we'll hold on to this for a moment. We'll wait until we get the ball back, as opposed to thinking, we don't have the ball anymore.
Let's get the ball. Just like, that is the thing you need to do with Atlanta United. If you don't have the ball, you need to get it. Do you want to let them have their passing and running clinic all night? This is what you get.
So it's hard to see. It is hard to see where they come back from that. For the idea of New York having the same three-goal performance, not just three goals, but also preventing Atlanta from scoring anything.
It's the second Atlanta scores, they've won the series.
Yes.
Which I think will happen. I say that Atlanta will score within the first 30 minutes again, and then the game is over. The interesting thing will be, well, the series will be over, is how New York responds. Because if they dig in and open up, then we could end up with a multi-goal game. But as you mentioned, it's not just the not getting an away goal thing. It's that they really needed to tighten up and limit the damage. Because had they come out of there 2-0, I mean, still difficult, but an entirely possible task. They've really, really dug themselves a hole. And I, despite all of their success, I think it's so clear the momentum is behind Atlanta. And they just have a better idea. Where Columbus had success against them in their first leg, What did they do? They pressured and took possession. So, I mean, the blueprint is there. I don't think that there's any coming back from this one from New York.
I think that the key to the game for New York, if something's going to happen, this podcast will hopefully come out before Thursday. So so it's next week where you'll find out what happened in the Thursday games, our radio listeners. I think the key is you buy Kamar Lawrence's new leg or whatever it is that he needs to be able to be.
He's not ready for that.
To be good. You go back to pressing, you press high, you press quickly, and you score in the first 5 minutes. If that happens,
yeah.
That's the only path that I see.
Yeah. I agree.
Because the one benefit that you have in New York, like the one thing that goes against you, regardless of whether or not you want to press high, Columbus did get the was able to find success with the pressing, but they were able to find that success at home. So, you know, it's so funny to think that that might be a Pyrrhic, that winning the Supporters Shield may have been a Pyrrhic victory in terms of giving Atlanta the home leg first. But that's just how things. Atlanta has such a heavy home advantage that it's crazy to think of them hosting MLS Cup. That having the second leg at home is supposed to be the advantage. Mm-hmm. But obviously New York are in a terrible, terrible place right now and need a very specific game plan executed to perfection.
Yeah. Yeah. To put it lightly. So that one was kind of all fireworks. I mean, it was interesting, and this is the That's So MLS part of it, is that that game had the was seemed uncompetitive completely, but had all the exciting storylines. And then we go to Portland and Sporting Kansas City in Portland, and for all the huff and puff, it's a 0-0 draw for both teams, with not a ton of chances created by either.
I'm not going to say, like, I don't think that it was some 0-0 draws can be boring because they are sort of unambitious, you know, not a lot of chances, etc. And I don't think this was that. But I feel like, you know, emotionally I was wrapped up in that early game, and then also the Canada game, which was very similar to this one, a very bolted down clinic of defense where both teams did not get that much until Jordan Heidema scored in the final 10 minutes of the game to put Canada over Germany for the first time at the U-17 level.
Well done.
Going on to Mexico in the semis. So I was kind of like emotionally wrung out a little bit by this point, I think. I found it harder to get into this one.
Well, I think where I'd sort of sent you a message being like, well, this game at least has something in it, is that this is more of a soccer nerd game where two teams that are pretty similar and both pretty good defensively, this was a bit more of like watching a chess game, but with a lot of harsh tackles on each other.
Yeah, and this not too many tackles and chess.
Yeah, or tickles. if you're playing it right, I'm told. The thing that made this game interesting to me was mainly the management of it. Now I'm blanking on the referee's name, and I can't immediately call it up here. But I thought he had a really good night of, you know, it was clear from the get-go these two teams were going to get into each other. And he was very, very careful about when he was going to pull out the yellow cards. And I thought just about every call was correct, that he wanted players to just get on with it. And some of them were taking chunks out of each other.
Robert Saviga is the referee here.
Robert Saviga, yes. Thank you.
Speaking of people taking chunks out of each other, the only thing that I forgot to mention that I loved in the Red Bulls game is when Alex Moyle takes a cleat or something to the chest. and he's so indignant about the fact that he had this contact and wasn't fouled that he just pulls his jersey up over his abs to show his road rash and just leaves it there for like a minute and a half. Like, guys, look at my ab wound.
Yeah. I love when players do that, where it's like their sock gets torn or something, and then they just standing by the referee, just showing the back of their leg with this tear, and you're like, yes, yes, we see it. It's an interesting way of proving your point.
A lot of people thought about this in the first half of this. I think the first half especially, you had the beautiful chance from Jorge Villafania off the post in 5 minutes in, which very much would have changed the whole complexion of the of the outing.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like Portland was unlucky. Clearly, they were the team with the better chances and the most pressure in this game. But playing against the best defenders in MLS is kind of where the things broke down there. Portland was also unlucky because Mabiala, I think it was around the 30th minute, if it even took that long, just, I think, landed on his leg oddly. I don't know if there's been an update, but... looks like maybe an Achilles or a leg, lower leg injury of some sort, and had to be stretchered off. And considering the ability that he's had this season, I thought that that was unfortunate. However, the young gentleman who replaced him, whose name I'm for, I think it's Tuiloma?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. The young New Zealand kid, I thought he had an excellent game. That was a big loss early on in the game, and he came in and stepped in and provided. So I don't think that really affected Portland that much. I think it says a lot that both coaches seem pretty happy with the result and happy with the refereeing. It was a good physical match, but, you know, I don't think there should be too much disappointment from either team. But aside from not really getting into it,
I think that
how do you rank this one? Where do you place it?
So the info that I have on Mabiala comes from OregonLive.com, which reported that it is an ankle injury that is still being evaluated.
He looked today to be in some pretty serious pain. I think Thursday would be an ambitious goal to come back to.
Yeah. So it was a non-contact injury in the 19th minute. Savarese says, right now we don't know much except that he twisted his ankle. We're doing everything possible to get him in the game.
All right.
So we'll see what
happens. Well, that's good. I mean, a twisted ankle is certainly better than a torn Achilles heel. Because he couldn't put any pressure on it at all. So that's where I thought it could be quite bad.
I thought that... I think that you're right in terms of both teams are reasonably pleased with how this has gone. I, as much as when you're the home team, I'm very much, you know, somebody that's very, very suspicious of the idea that as the home team, denying an away goal is job one, and then maybe score a goal if you want to or something.
Yeah, I agree. I'm against try to win the game.
Yeah, I'm against that line of thought, but I think that a lot of people were nervous on the Portland side because I think that Portland has a few things that they do well. Certainly attacking is one of those, but I think that Sporting Kansas City is a very like a complete team that can overwhelm you.
Yeah, if you absolutely. Let them.
And so, although it's weird to say you were the home team and you managed to hold them off, you know, if you had six shots on target and they had one shot on target and it was 0-0, that you did a good job. I don't think that there was opportunities wasted here. I don't think that there was pressure not delivered on. Well,
there were a few. Ebobasi had some real, real golden chances that he... Some of those balls, I think, are still rising. is Armenteros injured? I think I heard the commentator say he'd sort of fallen out of favor.
Yes. No, he had.
But I was sort of like, for how good he had been, I thought that it's been kind of harsh to see him completely out of action here and not even make an appearance in the game. Because I think there was a few of those that Armenteros would have had a bit more of a clinical finish on. So that's where I was a little bit surprised that, I mean, Bobosi has earned that spot, but I thought it was neither team were making many changes in this game, and I thought that that could have been one that might have had some impact.
I don't know enough to tell you why this is, but I do understand that to be the case. In some of the reading that I did about Bobosi and his sort of rise back into form is a part of that story is sort of Armenteros not being as favored, is my understanding, but I'm not entirely sure why. The other than that first shot, Johnny Russell gets on over the crossbar. The other VAR incident, it wasn't a wrong. You know, I can nitpick it a little bit. It wasn't necessarily wrong. Is this goal that I think happens in the second half where Valeri on a free kick sends it through to Ridgewell, and Ridgewell's shot is deflected and then is saved or deflected and then comes back to Diego Rubio is the other team. David Guzman, yes. The Ridgewell sends in a shot. It deflects back to Guzman. Both are said to have been offside. In a VAR call that exemplifies the policy of keeping the flag down, and it's been
right.
We've suspected at times that referees are swallowing their whistle with the thought that they don't want to make a bad mistake if and VAR will catch if there's an issue. But we've been told, and you've heard it on commentary a lot, that officials are officially saying, if you think it's offside, don't call it offside until after the play, and then we'll review it for VAR. I find this to be really frustrating. Players should play to the whistle anyways. I think that the existing system of you put the flag up, but you don't blow the whistle is a good one. What's frustrating about both VAR goals in both of these games is they came from teams that were really trying to make their way up the mountain. And it's just so frustrating for the players and the fans to think, we've reached this breakthrough. And then not only is it called off, but you didn't... They didn't have to put Portland's fans through that emotional turmoil if they just put the flag up as is accepted.
Especially when it's the linesmen, I don't understand that. Like, they make mistakes, it's fine. But like you said, like, put the flag up and then let VAR overrule it. It seems counterintuitive to just think, we don't want VAR to overrule a referee. Like, that's exactly what it's there for, is that it sees things that a person on the field can't see. It's not meant to take away any of the agency or ability. It's meant to be a thing that helps them. But if they're treating it like this sort of enemy, like, well, don't put your flag up because then VAR was just going to call it offside anyway. Like, I agree. I mean, we're big proponents here. If this is your first show of watching or listening to That's MLS, play to the whistle. Just play to the whistle. If there's no on-field signifier of it.
And that's the thing, is that I feel like the intention is good, and the intention is if there was an offside call that prevented a goal from physically being scored, like the players stop because the offside call is made, but it turns out that it wasn't an offside, that would prevent something from happening, so they want to see how the play would naturally have unfolded before they decided if the call was wrong or not. Mm-hmm. I see where the compassionate side is in terms of allowing people the most chance to score a goal possibly, but don't put people through that.
Yeah, I agree. The interesting question now becomes, a fair result for both teams. Now they're going to go down to Children's Mercy Park in Kansas City, and that place is a bit of a fortress. I believe this stat is they've lost three times Sporting Kansas City has lost three times at home in the last 2 years.
Oops.
So not looking great. However, playoff games are different.
And not just any playoff game.
Exactly. And I was walking home today and I was sort of thinking like, okay, who do I say takes this one? And I was like, well, it's got to be Sporting Kansas City. Like, they're just not going to lose at home. But then I think about the way that Portland played at home. And I think a number of people have said, you know, if there's five more minutes in this game, probably there'd be a goal in it. If it's 0-0 at the end of 90 minutes plus stoppage time, we go into added time. Is this a situation where Portland finds themselves taking penalties again?
This is a thing that sort of came up with the 2011 game was a semifinal, if I recall. It would have been because they're both Western Conference teams. Where Portland in Sporting Kansas City went something like an 11 round shootout in 2015, and you'll note that Portland called back to the TIFO from that game too. The Timbers Army did. So everybody sort of has this in mind. That shootout did take place in Portland, so the circumstances would be a little bit different. But such a unique encounter as that one certainly will be in the backs of the minds of everybody involved when it comes to the latter stages of the game. I think that when I think back to the Toronto Seattle MLS Cup series, I feel like Toronto was very much playing to not have penalty kicks in the second game. So yeah. I don't know. I feel like some of the players are definitely still there and some of the staff are still there and won't remember that momentous occasion in 2015. I think winning the penalty shootout is more of a benefit for Portland, where if Sporting Kansas City look like the dominant team coming through, and even though Portland had the most chances here, they didn't necessarily seem like the dominant team in the first leg.
I thought Sporting Kansas City played quite well, but I disagree. I thought Portland did look the better side. So I don't
better,
know.
Well, better. So this is my point. It's not necessarily the performance, right? Because Portland had more, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Portland certainly did play like and look like the underdog against trying to overcome a more dominant team.
Okay. Like, I hadn't quite read it that way, but I don't necessarily disagree. I think, yeah, okay.
So we'll see. So that's where I would say when you get back there, it's like if Sporting Kansas City feel more dominant and in the second leg appear more dominant, but haven't got that advantage when they come through, and it's getting closer and closer to extra time, I feel like Portland has the benefit of the seed of doubt.
I think they play with a little bit more edge. Sporting Kansas City is where they are through definitely an all-around team effort and magic and chemistry. But they also are where they are because of the fact that they score goals by committee. But when they don't, it usually means that they're not scoring goals. The balance of power kind of sways slightly towards Portland here. I don't think this is going to be a high-scoring game. And if this is really one of those ones where you go, if Portland can get a goal at any point, doesn't even need to be an early goal, but if they can keep Sporting Kansas City off the map, even a 1-1 draw sees Portland advance. So I think that's where it's a little bit more possible. But this is where I have, more importantly, two questions for you. And I'll ask them in order. First of all, just who do you think? Forget all of the hype about both teams and the incredible record of Sporting Kansas City. It's a playoff game. It's different. Who's your gut telling you wins this game and advances?
I'm going to go with my gut, And I'm going to say that the momentum and the energy is around Portland.
Okay.
As much as I described, as much as I described, Sporting Kansas City as dominant, it's like, it's because more than anything else, Portland seems like the protagonists, at least in that, in that thing. Everybody, sure. Everybody is focusing on Portland and what Portland is going to do and who is injured and who is not injured. And of course, what goals they score and are not able to score.
And all it takes is a Valeri free kick, and that could be the difference. Now, here's where things get interesting. Part two of my question is, which team do you think is more likely to beat Atlanta United in a final?
Oh, Sporting Kansas City.
Right.
No doubt.
Okay.
No doubt.
Right. And so that's where I'm torn, is I'm like, I really do think that Portland is going to win, but I am damn sure they're not going to beat Atlanta United. Whereas if Sporting can find a way to get through, I'm like, I think that there's a way. I think that they're defensively sound enough. Peter Vermees is smart enough. I think there's a way that they can just stifle and stymie Atlanta United and find a way through. I don't think it's likely that either team could beat Atlanta United, but it is. I knew you were going to answer that second part much faster than the first question.
The final whistle and train whistle and all of the hue and cry rang out in Mercedes-Benz Stadium, I definitely thought, I thought back to our discussion of MLS Cup final MVPs and my thought that if Sporting Kansas City wins, it's because Tim Melia is the MLS Cup final MVP.
Yeah.
And I thought of the kind of game that I imagined that being, and it certainly seems a step closer to possibility now.
And he's a big reason why Portland didn't score as well. I mean, I think he made six saves on the night. So it's also
had this huge, beautiful stretch save that was really good.
Oh my God. He was in the air for about 5 minutes before he came down. That was tasty. But shifting slightly away from playoffs, so that's the picture. Things will wrap up on Thursday night. We'll see who will be the conference winners. But MLS teams today also had to announce their whose contracts they were picking up the options for. It was deadline for the teams that are no longer in the playoffs. And I think we mentioned in the offseason, we will go into a little bit more detail with some of the teams. There weren't necessarily a ton of huge shocks, but of course our local team, the club we support the most, the Whitecaps, released their roster today.
Yeah.
Or at least the options they were not picking up. Reactions. Andrew, tell me about it. What are you feeling? What are you thinking?
I feel like the longer the day went on, the more the reality set in. Some names were present on the list of players that were not brought back. The key is the starting goalkeeper, Stefan Marinovic, was did not have his option exercised. I was also surprised to see Jose Aja not get picked up.
Interesting.
There was one more that I was also thinking, what? And my first thought was, last year they at length, At the time, Breck Shea's also not coming back. That didn't surprise me. At the time that they, last year when they made this news, they took pains to say, we're not going to, we are still negotiating with several of these players. In the end, of all the players that they did not exercise the options on, only Russell Tybert returned. But Mark Dos Santos has been very clear that they will not be coming back.
Mm-hmm.
He is not interested. When somebody asked this specific question, is there still any negotiations with people? He said no. So that's a surprise. It speaks to, he said that we've got a base of players that we are going to build a team that we're going to use to build a team with a specific identity. And we appreciate the contributions of everyone that's leaving, but this is what we're doing going forward. And he said that he's going to go find some new goalkeepers. I'm sad that Spencer Richie is leaving.
Me too.
So I guess maybe those are the three.
Was Ali Ghazal the other shock?
Ghazal was the other shock. That's right. I thought while there are a lot of players and people joke about Roberto Dominguez and Meyer Bevan being released because Marvin Emnes, because neither of them saw a minute anywhere, saw any shot anywhere. Now they're gone. There are a lot of people that you could see leaving. We're not, but I would have Marinovic, Aha, and Ghazal are all people that I thought, you know, made a contribution.
Yeah, I feel less so with Aha. I think that he got a tough shake. It certainly did not seem like he was missed from Orlando, but I don't think it's fair to put Orlando's woes on any one player.
Yeah.
I think he had a couple of okay games. I was surprised as well about the Stefan Marinovic move. It's no surprise. I've been a big fan of his. It's unfortunate things went down the way they did for him coming into the club and Osted kind of getting iced out. But I thought that he's done well. A helpful gentleman on Twitter today gave me a table of the types, the difficulty of shots and the goals against of Stefan Marinovic made him second worst in the league. But what I tried to kindly articulate was that if you had the front, the back four that the Whitecaps had, I feel like it's kind of unfair to just go by those stats that may not tell the full story. I think Marinovic played really well. I think he's a different type of goalkeeper than what we've had before. Had definitely made some mistakes, but I thought also was relatively good and solid. I liked his mentality a lot. But when you have one of the worst defenses in MLS, I think that tells you a lot as well. That being said, now that I also forgot he was occupying an international roster spot. So it gives the Whitecaps a lot of flexibility. Even though he was cheaper, Mark Dos Santos was pretty transparent in just saying, like, yeah, I mean, the price is all right, but we can free up an international spot and we can get somebody domestic for the same price, basically. Which, put that way, I kind of went, fair enough, and also, then why get rid of Spencer Richie?
Yeah, Richie is somebody that you always thought was a possible prospect, but I feel like maybe when they got Brian Rowe, that was kind of the next step for Richie would have been moving him into that 2A spot, and they did not want to do it.
Well, and the interesting thing, though, is that people have been talking about Brian Rowe, who is, you know, a tried and tested goalkeeper, maybe not one of the best in MLS, but he's certainly a serviceable goalkeeper, but he's also out of contract. And so the interesting thing will be to me is, so Brian Rowe, Sean Franklin, Christian Teixeira, and Kai Kamara are all out of contract. Will any of those players make it back next season? And I'm starting to wonder, this might be an entire goalkeeper rebuild, considering we already fired our goalkeeper coach. Assuming Mark Dos Santos is going to bring in yet another new one, I think it's fair to say he's going to start from the ground up in the goalkeeper position. We won't have any of our goalkeepers from this year back next year.
Yes, that makes sense. I don't know what we're going to see in terms of whether or not we see Franklin, Teixeira, or Kamara back. I'd love to see Teixeira and Kamara come back, of course. It seems like Dos Santos has some of his own ideas about what he like. Or it seems like he prefers not to be weighed down by some of these ideas. One of the things that I think is the most notable in terms of who got picked up that was not under contract, Eric Hurtado, Jordi Reyna coming back was interesting because you think that this is an opportunity to sort of let him move along on his way if you don't think that he has recovered and sort of developed personally to the point where you want him to be. David Norman Jr., Nicholas Mezquita are coming back. Mezquita coming back is great. Brett Levis is coming back, which is great. Donnell Henry is we kind of talked last week. It's kind of interesting. You know, I feel like, you know, this coming right after we did that episode, it's like, it's kind of some of the themes of these interviews is who survives the chop and who doesn't. And I think that it's interesting based on our discussion that Marinovic didn't make it, but they see enough in Henry that they decided they wanted to bring him back for a second year.
I was a little surprised by that too, although we didn't mention, I think he found a rhythm and fell into place a little bit. Mm-hmm. The reason that I think this is not as surprising is it's pretty obvious Kendall Waston's going to go.
Yes.
And if you're going to rebuild a team, that's one thing. But if you want to look at, if you go, who is the second best center back that we've had this season? It's Henry, without a doubt.
Yeah.
So I think it makes sense to have them. I don't know if that means he's going to be a starting center back next season, but I think it makes sense to have that option rather than start completely from scratch. Brett Levi's is great that he's back. I was really surprised that Mosqueda, his option was picked up. I thought that this was probably a year for him to move on, just out of consistency. He's had a good run. But I think especially towards the later part of the season, we just saw that I don't think he's ever going to be a starter for the club. And while he's been a good substitute at times, I feel like it's probably time for him to move on. The other thing to remember here, too, is just because you've had your option picked up doesn't mean that you're going to be playing here next season.
Yeah.
So a contract doesn't guarantee anything, really. If anything, it just, you know, it's attaching a certain price to these players. And that's where I think maybe Jordi Reyna, we may not see him back because that could be a valuable bargaining chip in terms of trades.
And also the expansion draft.
And the expansion draft. The thing that I was surprised by was the reaction from most people about Eric Hurtado having his option picked up. I would have been happy for the kid to see him move on and try to earn a starting spot at a club. But in terms of, if you want to talk consistency, over the last 3 years, Eric Hurtado has played the super sub role, I think, really well. And deserves a lot more credit for the amount of work he's put into the team and buying into the system. He's a versatile player as well. And again, okay, it's his option picked up. He may not necessarily be playing, but it just amazes me that a player can do so much and give so much effort. And in his case, over the last 2 years, score some amazing goals and some amazing game-winning goals. And to keep us in the fight and to have people have so little appreciation for that and just seem to only remember when Hurtado was playing more and would miss some sitters. It's clear that he plays well within our system. I'm happy to have him back, and I hope he does stay, and I hope he does well.
People don't understand the tourism potential of Hurtado Island. We joked about that
the loneliest island of them all.
We joked a little bit about that this season, but I think you're absolutely right. He's definitely proved his work. The other big thing is I'm looking at the for the other teams. Bakary Sagna is declined at the Impact.
Yeah.
Lamar has declined at Dallas. You had mentioned some interest in Minnesota.
Yeah, the first one is just sort of more of a personal thing, is that I noticed that Harrison Heath's contract wasn't picked up, and considering his dad is the coach of the team, I thought that was a little bit harsh. you must have really messed up this season. I was surprised that they didn't pick up the option for Ibsen. I know he's an expensive player, but I thought overall he had a really good season for Minnesota United, so that was a bit of a shock to me to not see him immediately picked up. And maybe that is a case of renegotiating a contract, but it seemed like with most teams, this is a pretty clear of like, no, they're out. Another interesting one was Ashley Cole is out at LA Galaxy, which I thought was surprising. I thought he was literally going to die there.
Well, it's interesting because I don't think he's one of LA's player, you know, big name, big money players that has been the worst this season. But we've certainly said before that LA needs to clear some benches. They can't have both all of the good players that are good and then also the players that are supposed to be good that aren't.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a smart move from the perspective of LA Galaxy is really the team that has sparked all of the press for MLS about being a retirement league. They just have had better success with some of those players. But it was pretty clear this year that Ashley Cole was just not fit enough to play in this league for the most part. And I know people are going to point to certain games and, you know, he's an athletic older player at times, but the league has evolved and players that at once looked like they were really big signings and going to be a major impact in this day and age now in MLS, we've shown that teams can figure them out and stymie them. I mean, if this is a league where Andrea Pirlo came in and couldn't find success, he's one of the greatest football players of all time. But at the end of the day, it's a physical league. It's a fast-paced league. You could also argue that like the quality on the end of those beautiful balls isn't always there. But if you don't have 11 players on the pitch that can run, that can flat-out run for a full 90, you don't stand a chance. And I think we're beginning to see a shift in the way teams build their rosters in that regard, that the physical fitness needs to be there. And not to say that Ashley Cole isn't physically fit, but there were lots of times this season where you saw him huffing and puffing, caught way out of position. I think it's just the evolution of the league.
You also brought to my attention this news involving Zach Steffen that...
Forgotten about that. So it was funny because last week it was reported that Zach Steffen might head to Man City. And at that point, I think it was reported by The Sun in the UK. So nobody was taking it seriously. And of course, many MLS fans were just like, yeah, it's impossible. He's nowhere near good enough. Like, he's good, but he's not that good. And now reports are flooding in that this is actually they're sorting out the paperwork for the deal that will see him go to Manchester City for somewhere between $7 and $10 million.
Interesting. It's interesting to see where he fits in, and it's always weird to think of these clubs that are so huge where they're going to sign somebody, and the first thing somebody talks about is, well, where are they getting loaned as soon as they arrive?
Yeah, I mean, that's the funny thing is, I feel like the majority of people have missed that point where they're just like, well, what's the ambition if he's just going to go to England and sit on a bench? And I'm like, he's going to immediately get loaned out. That's pretty obvious. But Man City's had some goalkeeper woes. It's a tidy bit of business from them. And they're a team that does this. They can burn $10 million on a goalkeeper that never sees a minute of action. And Zach Steffen goes to another probably pretty good European club, gets the experience, his price will go way up, his salary will go way up. And even if he's sitting on the bench, the opportunity to go train with that system in Man City with those coaches, for the age he's at, I would call that ambition, not a lack of.
Yes.
And crazy things can happen, right? Like, I think the next environment for him is he needs to be at the top level with the top coaches. And maybe he will challenge minutes to start there. But I expect, like you do, that he's going to go immediately out on loan somewhere.
It's funny that you talk about them having the money, because that's definitely what happened with Mix Diskerud, the former or the U.S. men's national team player who I believe was the...
Happened to Mix? Where did he end up?
He was on the New York City books, then ended up in Man City for for a half minute, and then got loaned to Sweden, and then to Japan, where he has had 2 goals in 16 games.
Yep.
For Ulsan Hyundai.
Yeah. Oh wow.
One of those players in the half life between too much notoriety for MLS or probably on a level slightly above MLS but not really high enough for England.
Mm-hmm.
Come to Besiktas.
An oldie but a goodie.
We got games on Thursday, and until then, where can we find you online?
You can find me online at That's So MLS on Twitter and on the Instagram. Both are a little bit different. I told you about a cool new follower we had. Now I forget who it is. Oh, Ben Fisk. Old Ben Fisk. the former white cap. It's always a delight to see that people are kind of still in the sphere. And so old East Ven, born and raised boy himself, now playing for Derry City, which I didn't know about. Ben Fisk is following us. So, I mean, Ben Fisk can't be wrong. Follow me on, or us on Instagram. That's who I'm last. Where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Team Bates, www.team-bates.com. I'm an editor at Howler Magazine, howler.com. And you can find this podcast at thatsomls.com, on Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else where great podcasts can be found. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Indeed. Also go find us on Facebook and like us there. That's OMLS.
We have a Facebook page still?
Oh, yeah.
That's not a good ad. Do that. Definitely find us on Facebook and like us. I am also going to find us on Facebook and like us. I'm going to get those updates.
Until next week, don't get so tough.
I won't.